As introduction suggested, I'll be talking about non-kinetic conflict dynamics. I use games quite regularly in my teaching and sometimes in my policy consulting work. There are almost always games about war, but there are almost always games in which the kinetic component, the force-on-force component, is secondary, sometimes even tertiary to what we're looking at. This presentation is going to be something of a smorgasbord, in that I'm simply going to go through a series of games that I've used or that I've had involvement with to highlight the many ways in which games can look at the kinds of issues that arise from conflict that aren't directly kinetic. Now, the reason that's often given for why we might look at these things is some version of the argument that wars of the future are likely to be unconventional, they're likely to be asymmetric. I would argue that wars have been asymmetric for a very long time. I mean, if we think that wars are newly asymmetric, we miss the decolonization of European empires and all the civil wars that characterized the 60s, 70s, and 1980s. We also know that all war is inherently political, that conflict outcomes are fundamentally shaped by social, economic, and political dynamics, and we can even have the obligatory St. Carl quotes up there to highlight that war isn't simply about force on force, it's about much broader social processes. Quite apart from that, it's important to recognize, and I think it's important to recognize particularly in the context of the audience we have here, that war fighting is not the only reason why professionals might be interested in modeling conflict dynamics and embedding those in a serious game or simulation. Those in the humanitarian and development assistance community have to operate regularly in fragile and conflict-affected countries and need to think about how they do their operations in ways that are safer, that are more effective, and so on and so forth. And I know David Hockday will be talking to you a bit later about some of the work that's being done amongst professionals in those fields. There are people who work in political risk assessment, both inside government and outside government, who need to think about these issues. There's people who work in human rights protection who need to think about these kinds of issues. There's journalists need to think about these kinds of issues. Journalists in training need to think about these kinds of issues. And those of us who, like myself, teach in the social sciences, obviously can find conflict simulations a very useful way to teach students not just about war, but about war termination, about peace operations, about stabilization operations, about humanitarian assistance, about development assistance in fragile countries as well. So I think there's lots of reasons why we want to look at the ways in which we can model conflict, and particularly the non-kinetic parts of conflict, in games and simulations. Now, there are some challenges, which were mentioned yesterday, in fact, in doing that. When we look at the social science of conflict, it is even more uncertain than the kinetic aspects. I mean, we know how artillery projectiles travel as a matter of physics. We know less about how ethnic conflict escalates, is de-escalated. We know less about the relationship between development assistance and political stability. We know less about how corruption and patronage may affect stability or instability. There are a large number of variables, often rather fuzzy variables. There's a very large number of competing theoretical models. There aren't many theoretical models about how an artillery shell gets from here to here. One could argue Newtonian versus general relativity, but no one ever does that. So really, there isn't much dispute over that. There's a lot of dispute over how electoral systems affect future political stability in divided societies. There's a lot of theoretical models. And what we tend to have are tendencies rather than invariant relationships. So social science will tell us that so-and-so tends to lead to so-and-so, that there's a correlation, but it doesn't happen every time. Contextual variables make a lot of difference, and so on and so forth. So the social science is very important, but it's always a bit fuzzy, and that fuzziness makes it hard to incorporate it into gaming engines, into simulation models, and so on and so forth. Moreover, and I think this is true of kinetic warfare too, political, personal, cultural, and institutional interactions play an important role in shaping outcomes. So in other words, when we're talking about stability operations, war to peace transitions, humanitarian assistance and development assistance in fragile and conflict-affected countries, it isn't just the objective situation on the ground that determines what happens. It's institutional politics, it's rivalries amongst organizations, it's the personalities of key leaders, it's political views, it's worldviews, all of that kind of stuff, all that kind of stuff of the dynamic, of the interaction of the multiple parts, makes a lot of difference in how outcomes occur. Interestingly, I was at a meeting of special representatives of the Secretary General, the person that the UN Secretary General sends off to negotiate peace agreements, And virtually everyone in the room, having done it, argued that personnel were in fact one of the key variables, that who you had as an SRSG and who they had as their staff support and who they were working with in terms of local diplomats made a lot of difference to outcome. So that further complicates trying to model these kinds of things. Now I'm going to start, as I said, what I'm going to do largely in this presentation is run through simulations I've used in my own teaching and in my own professional career. And I want to start with mini-sims, with very short, very compact simulations, conceptual games that are designed to perhaps challenge presumptions amongst an audience, offer quick insight, link to other materials in a course, break up the monotony of lectures. I've long argued that one of the advantages of gaming is it's a kind of intellectual cross-training in which you're forcing people to use slightly different muscles in their head than the ones that they use day to day. And also these things can be quite useful as a group icebreaker, just to sort of get group dynamics working in a way that's functional in the course. We in fact saw some reference to this in a different way when Brian Train was talking about abstract games yesterday in the project that he's involved. So I often use these in class, and the one at the top, the ultimatum game, I won't say much about the others, is extraordinarily useful. It's a simple experiment in which you tell people they have a certain resource to buy, say £100. One person gets to make an offer to the other, I'll keep £70, you can have £30, and the second person has to decide whether they keep it or whether they reject it, in which case no one gets anything. Economists will tell us that the optimum offer is 99-1. I'll keep 99, I'll offer you 1, and you being a rational utility maximizer will accept the 1 because 1 is better than nothing. Almost no one on the planet other than economists does do that. Now, I'm serious. There's experimental evidence to suggest that only economists behave that way, that normal people do not behave that way, and that usually it's somewhere around 60-40. And once you get to about 33%, cross-culturally, people start saying no. Even in very poor societies in which the payoff is real and very large, the sense of injustice outweighs the sense of material benefit. That simulation takes about a minute and a half to 2 minutes to do in the class. You invariably get a nice appropriate distribution with most people around 40, 60, 70, 30, a few people who went 90, 10 and got rejected. And instantly, you cut at something at the absolute core of conflict, which is it's not just about material resources. You can't just come in and build a new sewer system and expect that people's sense of injustice, their grievances are gonna disappear because you threw some in the US commander's emergency response program money at a local village, and suddenly they're going to forget 50 years of political tension with their neighbors. The other advantage of this mini-sim is there is tons of research on this. There is tons of research. This game is being done everywhere, from small tribes in the Amazon rainforest to university students all along the planet. And you have a lot of evidence of both some cultural variation, but surprisingly little cultural variation, and that variation is not necessarily Russians behave different from Swedes, it's that farmers behave differently from people who live in cities, that testosterone levels make a difference, not your sex, but actually your testosterone level makes a small difference. It's some really interesting findings. These kinds of mini-sims are very useful in getting a small concept across to students very quickly and then linking it in this particular case to a lot of broader research. I won't talk about some of the other ones. This is a role play exercise I use where people, it's like one of those murder mysteries where you have to find out what a village wants, but it's hard to find out, and it's in order to demonstrate how difficult stakeholder assessment is. In that one, I don't allow the people playing the women to talk unless they're asked questions directly. I often have males playing women, and it's quite interesting to how annoyed they get that no one's listening to them. But it's to highlight how difficult it is to actually find out what communities want when there are power structures within communities. This is one that Gary Malanti at the World Bank developed from not the last Connections US, but the one before it, and they actually now use it at the World Bank as a kind of icebreaker disaster relief card game that they use just to highlight the importance of coordination. Board games. I do occasionally use board games in the classroom. There is a problem with most commercial board games, which is something that has already been pointed out, in that they are difficult. They take too long to teach and to play to fit conveniently into teaching schedules. There are ways you can try and deal with that. I usually make it an optional assignment for bonus grades. I'm usually inundated with students who want to play, and so it's a supply of my time is the constraint, not the supply of students volunteering to play. When I was playtesting the disaster relief game I was demonstrating yesterday, I asked for for volunteers on campus to playtest it with me. And I had playtesters, I posted it on Facebook, I had playtesters within 4 minutes. So I don't have any trouble finding students who want to play. None of them were gamers, by the way. Just four students. I wasn't even during class time, no benefit other than the pretzels I offered, and it took 4 minutes to find students to play the game. Manual games do have the advantages of being mentioned by several of being customizable, including by students. So you can have students play a game and then say, what's wrong with this game? And that's an important point. Simulations for instructional purposes don't have to be right. Often if there's flaws in them, that's the teachable moment. I've even used a video game, Tropico, which is a tin pot Latin American dictator simulation. I've used it for hundreds of students, say, play this game, and then review it as if it were a serious simulation of political development in Latin America. The politics model is actually really powerful in that. The economics model is awful, and students have to think about what's right and what's wrong about the simulation. There are some specialist stabilization sims out there. This is Urban Sim in the background, and it's a bit washed out by the lights, which is one that the US military developed. They're typically not made available to the NGO or academic sector, which I think is a missed opportunity. And I have to say, in general, military war gamers have missed an opportunity in offering their services to the NGO sector to not only improve civil-military relations, but also to get an opportunity to network and learn from people who are doing training in the civilian sector. I think there's a real opportunity for outreach here, which is being missed. I'm not sure that Urban Sim is great for military officers. Frankly, I think it's a quite powerful program. It's got some weaknesses. It would be stunningly good to teach people in the World Food Program or Medicine Sans Frontières how military officers think about stabilization operations. If this game, which is official use only, were made available to UN agencies and NGOs, but it isn't. I think there's some missed opportunities. These are even worse, I'll add, in military exercises. You'll see here a kindergarten teacher with C4. I was in a US military exercise not too long ago as one of the civilian actors, and they just really wanted to teach someone to use C4. So they started teaching our teachers union, because they were doing unconventional warfare, and damn it, somewhere in the manual it said you find local leaders and you train them to be insurgents. And our teachers union rep, who was hired on Craigslist, came to us and said, look, I really don't know anything about unconventional warfare, but does it make sense you would go to a kindergarten teacher and on the first meeting say we can supply you with C4 and detonators? And I have to say that our Craigslist role players had a better sense of how you might overthrow a government than the particular special forces group I was operating with. And this is a problem of not having that network and just sort of bringing in civilians and then not maintaining that relationship. This is a specialist mass atrocity prevention computer program that they use at Columbia University. They use it there for university teaching, but they also use it in the field for teaching people from NGOs. Essentially a series of branch choices where you make a decision and it affects the degree of political tension. This is probably the best one that's out there in terms of a standalone software package to look at how you might de-escalate mounting ethnic tensions. Incidentally, I have references at the end of all these slides, so if you want to know more about any of these. This is something you can use, that I've used, experimented with last year, worked really well. Remember those, you know, choose your own adventure books, you know, the orc is at the door, do you run away or grab your sword, page 37? This is the electronic version of it. And this one is one about the Haiti earthquake, which is brilliant, where you play through as one of three actors. Ankle Rider is software, public domain software, whereby you simply use it to write one of these adventures. I've used it for students in asking them to write narrative fiction about conflict termination. And it works extraordinarily well. This is the Haiti one. The URL is at the end if you want to look at it. It's a bit hard to see here. This is part of a DDR story in a fictional country my students wrote. This, if you can see it, is one of the students' rooms with the branching stories all on stickies. So they ended up with each one of these is a story plot and a branch point. It goes all around the wall and here, and then it skips across the window and to the other side when they were storyboarding it. And it's extraordinarily useful as an exercise because they're having to think, what are the critical choices in demobilization of combatants, and what are the non-obvious choices? Not, you know, do you demobilize them or do you insult their mothers because you don't want a game in which the choices are obvious? Or what are the points where it's actually quite difficult to know what to do? And how do we embed those into the game? One of the other student groups, this group, this year, took the UN OCHA, Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, guidebook on negotiations with armed groups, and turned it into a game. So they took the entire how-to guide that the UN produces on humanitarian negotiations with armed groups and turned it into a how-to guide, trying to illustrate all the key points that were in the guide in a fictional setting. You can do larger scale crisis simulations, and I'll talk about mine in a minute. There's some specialist software that enables you to do that. ICONS project, Fabulusi, the open simulation platform that C-Change Simulations does, in which it embeds the story presentation, the communications tools amongst participants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It has the advantage that it provides you documentation. You've got a lot of data on what parties actually did as they interacted during the simulation. Frankly, I don't use that. I find that freely available web tools, email, instant messaging, voice over IP, Twitter, websites, blog, YouTube, works just as well. So when I run my big simulation I'll talk about in a second, I just let students use whatever the hell they want and make sure they copy everything to me. It does mean I read 15,000 emails that week, but anyway. This is the week-long simulation I run at McGill in the fictional country of Brianania. Set in a fictional environment because it allows me to put all kinds of issues in one particular place, and it also means that students don't know how it turned out. So there's a bit of everything there. It's usually played with about 130 students from two classes, although in a couple years I've actually linked up with a journalism class at another university that plays the media and actually runs a newsroom with assignment editors and so on and so forth. It worked fabulously well last year. Generally, they're playing all kinds of roles, from peacekeepers to local civil society, trade unions, human rights groups, different branches of the government, different insurgent groups, neighboring countries, UN agencies, NGOs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Usually at the senior policy level, but what I do is something you're not supposed to do in simulations, is I will zoom down from time to time from a senior role to a junior role. So you might be the UN force commander, but if a particular incident occurs, suddenly you're the Indian lieutenant on the ground faced with a tactical situation, the resolution of which will have strategic implications. So I do play the strategic corporal because from my point of view, what I'm trying to do with students is highlight the operational difficulties of doing these things in a way that don't come across in books. The simulation runs 12 hours a day for 7 days. That's, you'll notice that that's a lot of hours, like 84 hours. It's an optional assignment. They can actually do a class. Don't forget university classes are 39 hours. So my students are volunteering to put in an additional 84 hours instead of doing a written assignment. And I've had, of the 1,000 students who've run through it, I've had 3 who've chosen to do the written assignment. All the rest of the simulation. It plays real time. They don't get any time off from other university classes. They usually sit in the back of everyone else's lectures listening, you know, following their phones so they can slip out if the ceasefire breaks out of the lecture and go off to a meeting. And we play it semi-real time. Each hour is a day in equatorial cyberspace, and so we cover over the week 7 months of stabilization operations. It's face-to-face, it's electronic, it's email, it's voice over IP, it's any old way they want to interact. And they generate thousands of hours of face-to-face interaction, as I said, about 12,000 to 15,000 individual emails over the course of the course of the sim. And because I've run the same sim year after year, I can compare, I can look at how the Civil War turned out in different cases. I'm running out of time, so I'm gonna run through the next few slides very quickly. We've checked with students to see how effective they thought it was as a teaching tool. It was very effective. It's also being used to explore the psychology of violence. We had a PhD student who instrumented it to find out whether there was a psychological correlation between the psychology of students and the propensity to use violence. And there was. This is a game I demonstrated here, which grew out of the Connections 2 years ago, which is a humanitarian assistance disaster relief game. And I've used simulations for policy planning. In the UK, we had a simulation of Palestinian-Israeli negotiators on the Palestinian refugee issue, which was sufficiently realistic that the Palestinians tried to call Ramallah to get negotiating instructions from the Palestinian president. I had to turn that. No, it's not real. You're in a castle in Oxfordshire and you can't go call the president. But the Israelis are all really high ranking. I'm sorry, no calling home for negotiating instructions. That was extraordinarily useful in highlighting the extent to which the parties might agree to an agreement that couldn't be implemented in a practical sense. I did some work for the National Transitional Council of Libya, the Libyan opposition during the civil war in Benghazi, ran a policy simulation for them. And just recently, earlier this year, we ran one that was in large part about Syria for UNRWA, which is the humanitarian agency in the UN that deals with Palestinian refugees, on how the conflict might get worse and what the policy challenges were for all that. I'm out of time at this point. I've got 22 seconds left. At the back of the slides, which will be posted, you will find all the references for the stuff I've talked about and where you can find out more. So I'll end it there.
Thank you very much.